This is Neijing Now, prioritizing well-being. Neijing is the vitality that shields us from disease. Neijing Now, demystifying medicine, cultivating resilience, empowering host resistance, prioritizing primary prevention. I'm Dr. Jayashree Chander. I welcome you to another short clip exploring Neijing Now. Dr. Collins, welcome to Neijing Now.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to be here with you.
You're a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. Which policies of each of the candidates do a better job of prioritizing our well-being?
Let me just start by saying that I think, you know, neither of the candidates are presenting any sort of really radical types of programs, whether we're talking about income inequality or the environment or even health. However, within that, there are very stark and I think important differences between these two candidates. Some major issues. One, you know, on sort of the environment and sustainability. We just went through Superstorm Sandy. It was very interesting because we saw two prominent politicians in New York, Governor Cuomo and Mayor Bloomberg of New York, coming out very clearly saying that this is evidence of climate change. This is happening, and we've got to be aware of it. This past summer, we had the drought in the Midwest. We're here in Wisconsin. We experienced that. We don't have apples this summer because of the drought and various other things.
And last year, we had floods in the Midwest.
That's correct. And, of course, all the fires. I mean, we're really seeing in 1 year a lot of evidence that the climate is changing. And, you know, there's a robust evidence on the part of scientists that, you know, this is human-induced. Just coming off of that, in terms of the environment, I think there are some absolutely clear distinctions. Obama has not been super on the environment, but, you know, he set these goals for lowering emission standards for vehicles, very, very important. He's talked about green energy, and he put a lot of stimulus investment money in that. Romney has been the opposite, basically saying we've got to drill more. If we think about kind of our future as a society, as a country, as a world, that's not the way to go. Unless we begin to address these issues of sustainability of the environment, we're going to continue to dig ourselves further into a hole of environmental disaster, and that's going to lead to further economic disaster. So I think there's a real difference on that.
Romney's stance of drilling for more oil and being more lax on environmental regulations is basically taking a short-term view of things and prioritizing economic development at the expense of sustainable development. And I think that they need to go hand in hand. I think we need to stop looking at just the gross national product as our only measure of how we're doing economically. And there are other measures such as the genuine progress indicator, which takes into account environmental losses, you know, commute times, leisure time, volunteer work, parenting, all these other factors that are important in how we're doing as a society. I think it comes down to short-term priorities and long-term priorities. You know, in Neijing Now, we're always talking about priorities. I think that's a big difference between the two candidates, is having a short-term vision or a long-term vision.
Yes, I would agree with that. You know, even in the short-term vision, if we're concerned about increasing jobs, investing in green energy and more sustainable solutions are going to produce more jobs. And certainly in the long term, if we do not begin to invest more in this, this is sort of the technology of the future, we're going to sort of lose out. So even on sort of a basic economic question, I think there are real arguments in favor of moving in the direction of sustainable technology and energy and putting our eggs in more in that basket.
And probably with that, we'll also get more local jobs.
Absolutely.
What are the other differences in their policies that we should be thinking about when we're thinking about whether they prioritize our well-being?
Well, the other thing that I was thinking about has to do with this question of inequality. Again, here, there's a very stark difference. In terms of the United States, first of all, in relationship to other industrialized democracies, we have the highest levels of income inequality. The percentage of income possessed by the highest 1% is higher than it was in 1915 today. There are real serious consequences to these high levels of income inequality, consequences both for our democracy and consequences for levels of happiness as a society, for our sense of mutual trust of each other, for our sense of trust of our government.
Crime,
exactly. And not only that, also economically. I mean, I think Obama has been making an effective argument that real economic growth is going to come from investment, not for tax breaks for the 1% or the most wealthy, but investing in the middle class, investing in education, investing in health care. The policies of Romney and Ryan are going to, it's very clear, are going to further increase this trend of income inequality in the United States.
A lot of people hear income inequality, and it's sort of in a general sense, they can kind of see how it might be bad because inequality sounds bad. But, you know, there's a lot of people who would say, well, you get what you deserve, you get what you worked for, and you whatever you put into it is what you get out of it. And so, you know, if there's inequality, then that's just the way it is. So can you explain why income inequality would make for a poorer quality of life for everyone, including the people at the top?
Yeah. Economic power can translate into political power. If in a democracy we believe that everyone's interests has sort of equal weight within that society, but when you get very high levels of inequality, what happens, those who have the economic power are able to translate that power into political power.
They already do that, don't they?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, I think we're seeing this clearly. How much other good could be used for all this money that is being funneled into these campaigns? I mean, we're now up to $1 billion presidential campaigns. I mean, it's just absurd in the midst of a situation where our economy is suffering. But then, once government is functioning, the power of money to influence the types of decisions that are made, the laws that are passed that favor those interests, right? If economic power is able to impact the political process in that way, and then it can rig the system, rig the economic system in ways that impede competition. Again, concentrated economic power, even in a classical economic model, is not particularly good for capitalism.
So you're talking about basically we'll end up with government by the rich for the rich.
Yeah, absolutely right. A sort of a facade of democracy in which, you know, the powerful are able to use their economic power to essentially manipulate the democracy. If the government is not empowered to play a role of regulating the market, then this unfettered market system will further function to enhance the power of those who are the most wealthy and those who have the most.
I think we need to think of the government as the referee in a competitive playing field.
Yes, absolutely. And the government needs to have power in order to be able to do that.
And it needs to be impartial.
Yes, it does. Part of it means that, you know, you don't tear the government down. Without an effective and functioning government, we are sort of at the mercy of unfettered capitalism, and that's not a good thing for most of us, even for those at the top.
Exactly. Very well put. I just wanted to say one thing about the rigging. There's some concerns being raised about even the voting machines and who owns the voting machines.
That is the case in Ohio, that the company that owns these electronic voting machines that they'll be using, in particular in the key swing state, is owned by a firm that's owned by Bain Capital. Very disturbing. Apparently, civil rights advocates have called on international organizations of observers to come and observe our elections because they're so concerned about manipulation and efforts to suppress voting. We really are seeing some very blatant kind of attacks on our democracy and our democratic process, which is very disturbing.
There's an important distinction to be made so that people understand that when you're asking the government to referee the playing field, that's not limiting the freedom of the game.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's a very sort of powerful discourse out there right now that defines freedom in a very narrow way. The sort of classical liberal idea of limited government, which is important, right? I mean, we don't want government infringing on our rights to free speech, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, these are important civil rights and civil liberties. But it is important to understand that the government can play a role in helping to even out that playing field. And that without that, we are going to be subject to power plays, right?
I mean, we have market anarchy, basically.
Yes, that's right. It also is a way of thinking of ourselves, you know, as a society. We in the United States do tend to sort of idealize this idea of sort of the individual, which is wonderful in many ways. But we also need to balance that out with a sense that we do live in society and we do need each other. We're not born in a glass bubble and create everything out of nothing. I mean, we are a product of our school systems, we're a product of our communities. We need to help each other. We need to function as a society. And the government is a big part of that.
Beautiful. Very well said. Thank you. Was there anything else you'd like to add?
2 points. One has to do with national health care. Obama's Affordable Care Act makes an important step towards universal coverage, which I think is absolutely essential in terms of if we're talking about gross national happiness and our well-being. You know, it's not to say that this is a perfect plan, but it is a very important step towards increasing our well-being as a society. I think it's so surprising to see Romney, who implemented a very similar plan, very innovative in Massachusetts. It's been very successful. And now kind of backtracking on this. It's so perplexing. And Romney, of course, has promised that he would first day try to undo that.
Well, he's made a lot of promises about the first day.
Yeah. True. Exactly.
And I would actually call them threats and not promises.
True. Absolutely. And then I think also, I mean, the spending policies, right? I mean, everybody is concerned, as we should be, about the deficit. Romney and Ryan's tax plan is to basically this 20% across the board tax cut with no clear plan as to how that is going to be made up. This is going to mean devastating cuts to discretionary programs across the board. A lot of these are going to be cuts to programs that address the needs of the most needy in our society, cuts to education and to various different programs. The Conference of Catholic Bishops actually responded to the Ryan budget, basically saying that this budget puts all the burden of deficit reduction on the backs of the poor and, you know, lower middle class in this country, and that is morally wrong. This violates Catholic social doctrine. Again, clearly, the priorities of Ryan and Romney are ones that basically argue that we don't need to pay attention to social issues. We don't need to pay attention to poverty, that somehow if we give tax breaks to those at the very top, that the wealth will trickle down. And I think, you know, this has been disproved historically, even in the last Bush administration. We saw an increase in the deficit from a surplus in the 1990s. Those tax cuts at the very top did not produce a whole wealth of good paying jobs.
Do you think that given the surprising numbers of people who support Romney, do you think that half the country doesn't really care about the people who are at the most disadvantaged?
It's a very interesting question. No, I don't think that's the whole explanation, because clearly there's a lot of people in lower income bracket that are also supporting Romney. There is also, you know, again, this very strong tendency to view any sort of government program or help from the government as somehow not standing on your own 2 feet. You know, throughout life, there are different moments in which all of us are dependent at some point. We require a tremendous amount of care when we're born and when we're children. We require a lot of investment growing up. And when we get older or when we get sick, there are moments when we need to come together as a society to offer each other the insurance that we need.
Thank you so much. That was an excellent summary. We in America like to think of ourselves as the leaders of the world, that we are the strongest nation on the planet. And I'm wondering if you could offer your perspective on which of the candidates would actually make planet Earth the strongest planet in the galaxy.
Right. I think your question points to this very deep need to move beyond traditional conceptions of national security, to moving to a broader global sense. And this is very difficult, I think, for everybody to do. The challenges that we're facing as a world, as a planet, in terms of climate change, in terms of the environmental crisis that seems to be looming, the only way we're going to solve this is by finding ways to cooperate better than we have in the past. we need to tone down, as the United States, our sort of
militarism.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think this is huge. We spend more on defense in the United States than the next 15 countries, I think, combined. We need to begin to really turn that around. Romney, of course, has promised to increase the military budget by $2 trillion, more even than the Pentagon has asked for. I mean, this goes way beyond any sort of real legitimate security threat that we might face. It's threatening us environmentally, financially, and it sends a message to the rest of the world that we're the top dog and we want to impose, you know, ourselves, as opposed to we want to, you know, to act in a more cooperative global way. And somehow we've got to change that dynamic. Otherwise, we're not going to survive as a planet.
So you think Obama's policies are more likely to foster cooperation and friendliness with other nations?
Yes, I do. I say this with a little bit of trepidation because I think Obama certainly has not been averse to using U.S. military might, and he's certainly not a peacenik. However, when Romney calls Russia our greatest geopolitical foe, that does nothing to try to promote good relations with a very important power. That only undermines our security. That only undermines our ability to use our powers of persuasion, diplomacy, to try to promote greater cooperation on the issues that are concerned to us. That's actually more, in the long run, much more threatening to the United States. We cannot achieve our objectives by throwing our military might around. I think in the debates, Biden put it very well. The loose talk about war is dangerous. The Obama administration has been implementing very effective sanctions. The Iranian economy is suffering. And as Biden said, they don't have a weapon. This whole idea that somehow that they're on the verge of being able to shoot a nuclear weapon over to us is just absurd.
I'm sorry, I'm not a foreign policy analyst or anything, but I just feel that, first of all, the severity of the sanctions are very aggressive and essentially are a war, in my opinion. When you destroy an economy, you are destroying people's lives. And we know that here, as our economy has also plummeted, people suffer. And that is a war. The second point I want to make about that is that it's totally hypocritical of the United States to be worried about anybody else making a nuclear bomb. The third is, you know, when Pakistan made a nuclear bomb and when India made a nuclear bomb, where was the United States screaming and shouting and stomping their foot and saying, no, you can't do that? So I think that it's more of an excuse to get more of a foothold in the Middle East than anything else. I'm not a foreign policy analyst, but it's so clear and obvious to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, the United Nations has also called on Israel to reveal and to allow inspectors in to see what we know are its nuclear facilities. Our politicians are being held hostage, really, by Israel. The fact that we are letting Israel do this is detrimental to our own interests and stability in the Middle East. And Romney is bent over backwards, you know, to almost say that Israel can make U.S. policy towards Iran. I mean, that's ridiculous.
I mean, it really threatens our autonomy as an independent nation to make our own decisions.
I mean, Romney is basically giving up U.S. sovereignty to Israel on the question of Iran.
That's a threat to our national security.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And certainly, you know, if we're concerned about terrorism, the way to control terrorism is not to further inflame the arguments of the terrorists. That's just counterintuitive. It's counterproductive.
Seems so obvious.
It does seem obvious.
It is obvious.
I agree.
All right. To sum it up, thank you so much, Dr. Collins. It's been really very, very delightful conversation. Your 5-second summary.
It's not to say that any one option is the perfect option, but I think that the Obama-Biden side of things is really the clearer choice in terms of gross domestic happiness and our well-being and the survival. You know, I'm not going to say the planet is going to survive, but I think if to move in that direction, that's the choice we have.
Great. Thank you so much. I'm Dr. Jayashree Chander, creator of Neijing Now, a podcast about prioritizing well-being, on the web at neijingnow.org. Neijing Now is independent and entirely listener-supported. If you enjoyed the clip, please share it with your friends. Like us on Facebook and donate generously. Your support is essential to keeping Neijing Now alive.